Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Nathan Hobson, and I am a host for the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, a member of the New Books Network. Today, I'm going to be talking with Hans-Martin Kramer and Orion Clouton about their co-edited volume, Buddhism and Modernity, Sources from 19th Century Japan, which is out from the University of Hawaii Press this year, 2021. This is a welcome new collection of 20 sources on modern Japanese Buddhism, translated and with introductions. The editors and translators have curated a diverse array of materials focusing on the struggles of Japanese Buddhism to come to terms with, to accommodate to, and to find its way in modernity from the mid-19th century into the early decades of the 20th. The book is helpfully divided into five thematic sections: sectarian reform, the nation, science and philosophy, social reform, and Japan and Asia. Each contains works by important, influential Buddhist thinkers such as Inoue Enryo, Shimaji Mokurai, and Shak Soen. Overall, Buddhism and Modernity sketches out a picture of Japanese Buddhism negotiating a new sense of nation, religion, empire, Asia, and the proper shape of society in a period in which Japan's Buddhist traditions were facing novel, complex, internal and external challenges. The book will be of interest to scholars of religion in Japan, of course, but also the translator's introductions to each selection and the length of those selections as well make it suitable for classroom use. All right, gentlemen, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me and for coordinating the time zones here. So Hans-Martin Kramer and Orion Clouton, it's a pleasure to have you here. And so we're going to be juggling a little bit with the audio going back and forth between the two of you. But I just want to open up with a couple of questions about how this project came about. What was the inspiration for doing this particular project and bringing together this team working with, and how did you select these sources?
Right. Maybe I'll just start, and Orion can, of course, jump in and correct me and add. Thanks for having us, first, of course. The origins of this project actually are in the dim and distant past. I think it must have been around 2011 when Orion and I met up in Kyoto, and we were discussing sort of the state of studies on modern Japanese Buddhism, Kindai Bukkyo, in the English language, and realized that we were really at an interesting point in time where the pace of the field was picking up. Usually Buddhist studies in the English language on Japan would have been on the medieval period, contemporary stuff, perhaps a bit on the early modern, but fairly little on modern Japan, Meiji to sort of World War II, perhaps. But around 10 years ago, there were really many PhD students working on this. We knew a number of them personally, especially Orion. We were thinking it was a good time to introduce the field broadly, more, not just have the monographs that were coming out, the PhD thesis that were about to be finished, but to sort of get a sense of the state of the field. And we were thinking a good format would be to have a source book to actually get all those people, mostly younger people who were working on all these diverse topics within modern Buddhism, to take their sort of their favorite authors and translate something by them and introduce it in English. So that, from my point of view, that was basically the point of origin of this project.
Yeah, so, great. Orion, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, it also reflects like a more general trend of what was going on in Japan at the time, because even in Japan, like modern Japanese Buddhism was not, you know, a real topic per se before the early 2000s. Like you do have some research, especially from the 1950s and late 1950s and 60s. But after especially 2001, 2002, you really start to see a lot of younger scholars who are now in their 50s and 60s, like producing a lot of interesting stuff that actually managed to impact how people understood Buddhism in previous eras, because a large part of it also dealt with historiographical issues, with, you know, part of my work is also connected to that particular aspect. But you see more people, after the impact of these early studies, you see more people from other fields, like working on ancient Japanese Buddhism and medieval Japanese Buddhism, also getting more and more interested in modern Japanese Buddhism and post-Meiji Buddhism, because this is when all the concepts that we actually use to describe these previous years are formed and discussed and, you know, established in general.
Yeah, thank you. And for me, just personally, as someone who originally became interested in Japan in part through an interest in modern religion in Japan back when I was a teenager, and has since strayed very far afield and feels a little embarrassed about that today, this was a lovely chance to sort of reacquaint myself with what's going on in the field and to see some of these sources. So I really I found it a fascinating read. And that starts with the introduction, which sets the stage for all of the individual sources and for the translator's introductions that make up the rest of the book. So I want to start by asking you two questions about the sort of mise-en-scene that you're doing here in the introduction. Near the outset, which is, and I should point out that the introduction is co-authored by the two of you. Yes. Okay, yeah. And so in the introduction, you write, quote, "Japanese Buddhists enthusiastically embraced the changes necessitated by the modern age, which they interpreted as new possibilities." So based on that passage in particular, which I think sums up a lot of interesting things that you're doing here, I wanted to ask first, what was the state of Buddhism in Japan entering the mid-19th century? And then what kinds of changes were required or desired and sort of came about in the early decades of Japan's modernity to Buddhism itself? Then the second question I want to ask here is, you also write that Japanese Buddhism, as we know it today, was formed in this era of tremendous change. And for those of us, you know, as we're less familiar with Japanese Buddhism in particular, what does that mean, both that it was formed in this era and sort of what does Japanese Buddhism mean in that sense? What are the features of contemporary Japanese Buddhism that form in this crucible of the sort of changes of early engagement with modernity? And then how would you summarize the five major issues that Japanese Buddhism has had to navigate and which you lay out in your introduction?
Okay, so I'll take the first one. What was the state of Buddhism in Japan entering the mid-19th century? I think the answer to that is connected to the broader issue of Tokugawa international relations. As you can actually find in most Japanese history manuals today, the early Tokugawa rulers decided to place very strict regulations on foreign trade and relations. That's the policy historiography for most of the 20th century referred to as Sakoku, though this is obviously a term that didn't exist yet in the early 17th century. So part of this policy of strict control on foreign relations included expelling from Japanese territory, all Christian missionaries, and then also banished the very practice of Christianity. At the same time, the Bakufu was taking that kind of action in terms of foreign relations. They were also seeking to regulate Buddhist institutions by organizing the temples of each sect as branch temples of one single head temple. So each Buddhist school would have a head temple or a honzan to which all other temples would respond, and that head temple in turn would respond to whoever Bakufu people were in charge. This was actually more or less already in place in certain Buddhist schools, But the Bakufu decided to make the structure a bit clearer. So what is important for us here is that from the early to mid 17th century, all people in Japan were required to affiliate with a local temple, which would issue a certificate saying that we're not Christian, nor members of any other group deemed particularly problematic or heretic by the Bakufu. In return, these people became parishioners and supported the temple financially and so on. So what you have from around the mid-17th century is the development of a structure that made anti-Christianity one of the very reasons for Buddhism to exist the way it did. And Buddhists did internalize this to an extent that you can see anti-Christian treatises being produced all over the Edo period and even into the Meiji period. And this is even though, despite the fact that Christianity was now nothing but a virtual enemy. There were no actual Christians in Japan. We have a whole Kakure Christian tradition, but this is not something that, you know, people actually came in contact with. So what changes in the mid-19th century, though, is that this virtual enemy now becomes more and more real. From the 1820s in special, incidents with ships from Western nations become more frequent in Japan. And from the 1850s, even before the impact of Perry's arrival, you already have a number of books on religion published by Christian missionaries in China circulating in Japan. So by the mid-19th century, you have the Buddhist clergy with a very strong sense that they exist very much in order to keep Christianity away from Japan. And on the other hand, you have a new wave of Christian missionaries trying to actually gain entry into the country. So this is more or less the situation of Buddhism in general by the time that our book actually starts.
Right. In terms of, as you put it, what kinds of changes were required in this period of Buddhism, let me perhaps first point out that our perspective is less that of what was sort of objectively required, perhaps. We're not writing from a stakeholder's position of Buddhism. But we're really focusing on what the people at the time, the historical actors, thought was necessary. And of course, that's what we introduce in the book. So just to clarify our basic perspective here. And I think one thing that's important, another point that's important to emphasize is because you also quoted some passage from our introduction that said that by and large, Japanese Buddhists were ready to embrace new things, reforms, innovations, changes. I think what's important is that we adopt to some degree in our introduction a global comparative perspective here. And in that perspective, you see that religions around the world were faced by similar challenges of modernity, and they reacted quite differently. And within that spectrum of reactions, I think what you can see in Japanese Buddhism is that, in fact, by and large, many Japanese Buddhists were ready to face these challenges and react to them and not try to, you know, steer away, have some conservative reactionary stance towards them. So that's in a comparative perspective, that's actually interesting to see. So the challenges that we're talking about, of course, are the challenges posed to religion by modernity, what you could abstractly call new modes of secularity, which basically means that there is a new mainstream within a society that basically evolves around a secularist outlook. Religion is no longer naturally a part of everyday life, the makeup of society, the political order, but it has to explain itself. It has to sort of explicitly make a stand towards other social spheres that now become more distinct, such as politics, but you could also say art, science, which it was intricately interwoven with in the pre-modern period. And now this is no longer self-explanatory. And in Japan, perhaps one of the most conspicuous expressions of this is the new term, the new concept of religion that now suddenly emerges and becomes extremely relevant for the stakeholders, for the Buddhist priests in our case. They have to somehow all of a sudden define themselves vis-a-vis this strange thing, religion. Are they a religion? Is Buddhism a religion? If yes, what does this entail? What is not a religion? And so you get this strange situation that the state is grappling with this term religion. It's policing religions. And the religions themselves have to sort of try and see how they fit into this scheme. And this is one of the core crystallizations, you could say, of dealing with these new modes of secularity, that sort of on both sides, on the secular realms and the religious realm itself, you have all these new configurations that intellectuals and sort of actors, activists on the Buddhist side have to deal with now.
Yeah. I wanted to cover that last little thing that I asked, which is about those sort of five major issues as well. And the reason I want to make sure that we talk about that now is because you actually divide the book up based on those five sections, right? So there's sectarian reform, the nation, science and philosophy, social reform, and then Japan and Asia. So if we could just make sure that we cover those before we move on, that'd be great.
Yes, absolutely. And this is basically how we try to render the sort of abstract observations that I've just put into words more concrete for the purposes of the volume. So I'm happy you mentioned it. And indeed, perhaps the most obvious reaction on the side of Buddhists was sectarian reform, which is why we put it up front in the first chapter. Because I think that the first need that was felt by representatives of the establishment was to do something with their own organization, to reform their own organization in terms of, let's think about the precepts, right? The rules for priestly life, but also things like the borders of the sects, cooperation between the sects, and of course, down to things that touch the substance of what these Buddhist sects were about, rituals, rites, perhaps even doctrines. So all of this was in flux and very much debated, certainly, and also in some schools more than in some others, reformed. So sectarian reform was at the forefront, you could say, I think for many of the people that we picked up as authors of the original texts. The second part, as you mentioned, is entitled The Nation, and it's another very important point of reference for these authors. In a way, they had all been tied up intimately, as Orion briefly summarized, with the nation, as it were, in the early modern period through this system of people were checked whether they were Christians or not, and basically had to register with Buddhist temples. So it was intimately tied up with the nation. This is severed in the 1860s, 70s. So the whole relationship to the nation becomes, all of a sudden, becomes much more fragile and unclear and uncertain, and they have to renegotiate. And most of the authors are pretty clear that they want to be on the side of the nation, right? They have this phantom pain. They want to come back to this old, nice, cozy relationship in a way, or at least some reformed version of that. So many authors are pretty clear that, yes, this is our Buddhism is something, it's really good for the nation, and the nation actually needs us. So it's a very affirmative stance in most of mainstream Buddhism. We kind of move away a bit from these political aspects in section three on science and philosophy, where another aspect of this new secularist modernity and another challenge is faced by the authors we took up, and that is the relationship to science, which in that period could mean natural sciences, but could also mean the humanistic sciences. So it's more the Japanese idea of gaku or gakumon, which can encompass both, and also encompasses philosophy, because the challenge that was felt was, of course, by the natural sciences, which meant that, say, the work, astronomical, cosmological worldviews were now no longer set by scripture, but by observation and so on. But also the historical sciences in particular, of course, meant that especially revelatory religion, but also, legends about the life of the Buddha and so on, were now all of a sudden subjected to historiography, and other standards were now suddenly valid for those kinds of stories. So these challenges seen coming from science were really thought of as coming from various sub-sciences here. And again, taken up very explicitly by many of these Buddhist authors, seen from very early on. So the first writings on Darwinism were actually by Buddhist authors in Japan. It's quite interesting to see. We then have a chapter that's perhaps a bit unusual, it was not in the original chapter plan, I think, which is on social reform. So we felt it was important as a topic that's a bit less conspicuous, especially in the English language scholarship on modern Japanese Buddhism, perhaps not so much in the Japanese language scholarship, which is a social reform broadly conceived, because that was actually an area of activities that's very conspicuous if you look at what's happening in the 1880s, 1890s, especially with all the Buddhist schools that were founded, hospitals, all sorts of institutions of social reform and so on. And we also included chapters on Buddhist marriage, views of women, education of girls in this chapter. So I think that's a very interesting chapter. And the last chapter that's also a bit unusual, Japan and Asia, reflects a lot of the scholarship that was simply going on. So we knew that we would have a number of authors that could speak on this topic, and we thought it would be very good to include how Japanese Buddhists reached out to the continent, to other parts of Asia. Of course, you think of also the cooperation with Japanese imperialism, even from an early stage onwards, where Japanese priests sort of accompanied troops to the continent, or you could even see the proselytization efforts by some of the Japanese sects as part of reaching out to the continent more broadly in economic and political military terms. So these are some of the issues we dealt with in the last part. I think Orion wanted to say something about how all of this plays out up to the contemporary present period. Is that right?
So one of the questions I think Nathan also asked us was like, what are some of the features of contemporary Japanese Buddhism that actually formed around this time? And I'd like to mention one of the, I think, most people that, especially who are coming from other Asian nations to Japan, find one of the most characteristic features of Japanese Buddhism, which is the issue of clerical marriage in Japanese Buddhist schools. I think Richard Jaffe mentions in his 2001 book that today approximately 90% of the Buddhist clergy are married, and that, for instance, in the case of Soto Zen, about 80% of the priests inherit their temples from a family member. So most Japanese Buddhist temples are now inhabited by married Buddhist clerics and their families, and also, according to Jaffe in the same book, clerical marriage has become so entrenched in Japanese life that about 73% of parishioners would rather actually have a married cleric serving as their abbot. The fact that most Japanese Buddhist priests are able to marry and have children is something that Buddhists in other Asian nations, again, such as China and Thailand, usually find very odd. But at the same time, it's something that you find as, you know, one of the basic characteristics of Japanese Buddhism in any, you know, introduction to the topic that you find. This particular aspect of clerical marriage was very much a product of the modernization process of Buddhism in Japan, with the decriminalization of clerical marriage in 1872. You can see more about like how precept-oriented Buddhists dealt with this issue in the chapter by Mike Auerbach, included in the source book.
Yeah, and it is a fascinating thing about Japanese Buddhism, especially when you consider that might make actually the rates of clerical marriage higher than the rates of marriage for the population at large these days. I didn't actually check that, but the way that the media portrays the, you know, young men and young women not getting married, it certainly feels like there are more Buddhist priests who are married as a percentage. So let's jump into each of the sections. So I took the liberty of choosing one piece from each of the five sections, which represent those five big categories. Again, sectarian reform, the nation, science and philosophy, social reform, and then Japan and Asia. There are a total of 20 chapters, and as much as we have dedicated listeners, we thought that if it was longer than War and Peace, they might not listen to the whole thing. It would be an audiobook rather than a podcast. So we're just going to focus on five chapters that I personally found very interesting, but I think also represent the sort of zeitgeist of each of these themes that you've chosen. So the first one of these from that first section on sectarian reform is chapter two, an 1889 piece by Nakanishi Ushiro called On Religious Revolution. As is pointed out in the translator's introduction, Nakanishi was an influential writer. So it's important that he's calling for reform, I think, and making a distinction between new and old Buddhism. So can you tell us who Nakanishi is and what's significant about the selection here?
So Nakanishi was not actually born into a Buddhist family, but actually into a Bushi household in Kumamoto. He was born in 1859, and during his younger years, he studied, of course, you know, the Chinese classics. His father was a teacher of Chinese classics. And but he studied not only that, but also English and Christianity. We're not really sure where exactly, but we do know that after a while, like he went to Doshisha, which, you know, in the end became Doshisha University, which is also, like, as you know, a Christian institution. Into, we don't really know exactly when, but into his late 20s, he seems to have gotten more and more interested in Buddhism. And in 1887, he finishes the work on religious revolution, which is partly translated in the source book. In this work, Nakanishi will claim that Buddhism, as it existed in Japan at the time, should, quote unquote, evolve to transform into its ideal form. In his words, that old Buddhism should transform into new Buddhism. What is interesting about his work is that he dedicates a whole chapter to discuss the 16th century European Reformation started by the likes of Luther. And he claims that Japanese Buddhism needed to actually learn from that and actually experience a similar process in order to become what it should become. As for the selection translated in the source book, we chose precisely a passage where Nakanishi explains this dichotomy between old and new in detail. This rhetoric of old Buddhism that needs to evolve into a new Buddhism will have quite an impact at the time and will influence a whole generation of younger Buddhists who will actually go on to develop their own associations, like, for instance, the Fraternity of New Buddhists, which is also dealt with in the source book and the chapter by Jolyon Thomas.
Yeah, let me perhaps add just briefly that I think especially this Nakanishi chapter is also relevant because it shows how some of the core concepts were negotiated and how important Christianity was as you know, something that they felt they needed themselves to set apart from the Japanese Buddhists. But they also, at the same time, negotiated with it. I hesitate to say made borrowings from it because that doesn't quite do it justice. But for example, Nakanishi does talk about the centrality of faith, Shinko, which is, as such, the term is not necessarily a central, you know, traditional Buddhist term, but it's something that becomes more central in the overall religious debate in the 19th century. So it's certainly somehow the dialogue in the broad sense with Christianity leads to that becoming central. But then Nakanishi does quote Buddhist scripture to make sense of the term. So it's an attempt to sort of answer to the Christian challenge, to the missionaries' challenge in Japan. But it's a complex negotiation process that's going on there on the conceptual level.
Yeah, I did. This was one of the things that I really enjoyed about this particular selection, right? The sense that there's not a sort of Buddhist reformation in the sense of the Protestant Reformation, but that same sense of sort of crisis, and then the emergence of this new understanding of and importance of the idea of faith as well. I think it really nicely speaks to the kinds of dramatic transformations of Buddhism in this era. And that actually, it's this same 1880s that gives us our second selection, which is from part two of the book, On the Nation. Here I'd like to discuss chapter 5 on the national doctrine of Greater Japan, which is from 1882 by Shaku Unsho. So unlike Nakanishi, it seems to me he's more of a traditionalist in a sense, adhering to a stricter idea of monastic Buddhism, monastic precepts, and coming out a little bit more strongly against Christianity, thinking of it as sort of heretical. He also is, though, very deeply and actively involved in the modern myth-making, connecting Buddhism and the imperial house, which he seems, at least to me, to be doing through an appeal to a kind of prelapsarian Buddhism, right, in antiquity. And so I found the contrast between these two pieces also quite interesting.
Yeah, so this is actually one of the most interesting aspects about Unsho, because when we think about modern Buddhism, of course, quote unquote, we think, of course, of more liberal characters like fighting feudalistic institutions and trying to create a Buddhism more appropriate for an age of like science and reason. And actually, like I'd say about 70% or 80% of the people like dealt with in the source book have more or less this perspective, right, of trying to adapt Buddhism into a new age, of trying to borrow, while like at the same time they are like heavily criticizing Christianity. They are also at the same time borrowing all these new concepts in order to reframe Buddhism in a more like sympathetic light and emphasize Buddhism's utility vis-a-vis the state. But in the case of Unsho, he is exactly the opposite of what we think when we think like modern Buddhism. And actually, for example, if you go back to all the introductions to the history of modern Buddhism written in the late 50s and 60s, which I just mentioned, a little bit earlier, what you'll find is actually they are describing, they actually draw a lot from the same old and new dynamic. You can see, for example, they say that, you know, for example, the previous, the feudalistic Buddhism, as they call, is the old kind of Buddhism, right? And then you have this modern Buddhism trying to fight this feudalistic Buddhism, and the modern version of Buddhism is more social. At the same time, it's more individualistic and so on. So you have the same, I could say, like perhaps framework that you see in works like those of Nakanishi, also appearing in post-war scholarship that is trying to actually understand what was going on around that time. And they too understand, for example, Unsho as an example of old Buddhism. The kind of old Buddhism that Nakanishi is mentioning in his work, actually, it's going to be, you know, picked up by several other groups later on. And they're also going to, they're actually going to use Unsho as an example of what old Buddhism is. And Unsho is actually going to embrace that to an extent, right? So it's quite interesting because he is also talking in all the same terms and the same concepts of modernity. At the same time, he's not like the character that you think of when you think, you know, a quote-unquote modern. But he's trying to respond to issues, for example, like church and state, like separation of like politics and religion, which is something very much, you know, modern from around this time. And this work that we partly have translated here from 1882, this is actually what he's trying to do, right? He's trying to take this new concept of the division between, you know, the separation between politics and religion, and speak of this tradition of connection between the emperor and Buddhism in this new framework. So you can also read him as very much so as an example of what, you know, Buddhism experienced into modernity. And although this is not very present in his work, he's also going to try to reframe, for instance, the idea of Buddhist precepts into the modern context of national morality, for instance, which is something that was being heavily criticized by all this like new Buddhists, you know, all these old Buddhists, they just care about precepts and not getting married and so on. And he's going to actually try to, no, precepts are important. Look, the nation is actually calling for, you know, morality and ethics and so on. And precepts can actually play a role in that context. So it's quite interesting to try to understand him not as an example of, you know, tradition and of old Buddhism, but as actually of something trying to reconstruct, of a tradition trying to reconstruct itself.
Okay, so I want to move on to part three, because we've been talking about this sort of clash between, right, in a sense, the sort of tensions between reform in the sense of modernization and reform in the sense of sort of retooling traditions and precepts and sort of how to adapt and adopt, new ideas and how to adapt old ideas to them, to the new world. And this that same theme of sort of confronting, of course, the modern, runs throughout the whole of the book. But I did find this in Science and Philosophy to play out in quite a different and very interesting way. And that's part three. I wanted to talk about Murakami Sensho's Discourse on Buddhist Unity, which he wrote in 1901. I found this quite thought-provoking because he's struggling with the problem of diverse interpretations of the canons and the existence of multiple sects of Buddhism, right? So he's not just struggling with sort of modernity and modernization, but also problems that are very much internal to Buddhism and to, quote unquote, religion, which is, of course, as Hans Martin pointed out, something also newly being struggled with. So what does it mean that all of these sects claim to be, the Buddhism? So Murakami is a professor at Tokyo Imperial University, which is the prestigious university, and he's a pioneer in Buddhist studies. So for me, it was fascinating that he's taking the position, and I'm quoting from the translator of this piece, that, quote, despite knowing very well that the teachings of the Mahayana did not all radiate from the mouth of the historical Buddha himself, and that the bodhisattvas were not real beings flittering around our cosmos, he still believed in Buddhism. In fact, it made him believe even more. And I'm reminded of some of the, other literature about this sort of Meiji moment and the sort of genesis amnesia of modernity on the one hand, but also I think of, Basil Hall Chamberlain's writings about the modern emperor cult and talking to, Japanese associates who would say, well, we know it's not real, but we believe anyway, right? That sort of fetishism that characterizes a lot of new belief structures and so on. And so this, I thought this was a really interesting piece for somebody who's struggling with those issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Discourse on Buddhist Unity, like it was originally published in 1901, but Murakami's sort of quest to unify or to actually find some sort of consistency, and this is a term he uses too, like much earlier, ikkan, like consistency, and Buddhism actually starts much earlier in the late 1880s. Murakami was originally born in a very small Jodo Shinshu temple in Tamba province, which an area that today belongs to Hyogo Prefecture. He studies in Kyoto for a while and marries into this temple in what is now like Aichi Prefecture, and things doesn't really. They don't really work out, and he ends up moving to Tokyo in early 1887 to teach at what is now Komazawa University, at the time of Sotoshu Daigakuri. And right after he arrives in Tokyo, like he starts actually doing all these public lectures on how to use Buddhist logics, like to counter Christianity, which was actually one of the main issues at the time. This is 1887. This is the same time that, Inoue Enyo is publishing his main works, his early main works, and so on. So one of the key issues at this time is to define Buddhism as a religion better than Christianity. And it was not only a motivation for him, but to most, like other Buddhists in Japan, as you can see, like in the source book, it's actually quite a recurrent topic, right? Like, you have this whole generation of like three decades of people like trying to in many different ways counter and criticize Christianity to explain and to put Buddhism, to depict Buddhism as a better religion for several different reasons. The thing is, when you're discussing with Christians and trying to prove that Buddhism is a religion better than Christianity, well, like Buddhism has no Bible, right? And the idea also was that the types of rituals performed like in all these different Buddhist schools, like they were just so different amongst themselves, like, let alone like if you include also like Buddhism in other parts of Asia, like it gets even more discrepant. But what Murakami set himself to do is with this understanding that he needed to have this unified whole to talk against Christians, in a sense, he tries to actually find some sort of consistency in Buddhism to redefine Buddhism as a unified system that, quote unquote, like made sense in the context of 1880s and 1890s Japan. And in the process of finding some sort of unifying key for Buddhism, one of the main issues he tried to respond to was the criticism that Mahayana Buddhism, like the broad group of Buddhist traditions all Japanese schools belong to, was not truly preached by Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha. Due also to the impact of European Buddhology, the idea that the historical Buddha had not preached the Mahayana Sutras was by this time, by the late 19th century in Japan, already more or less common sense among Buddhists, especially Buddhists among Buddhists of the younger generation. And this is also like the idea that, okay, like, so your Buddhism was actually not preached, the Buddhism that you practice, that you experience, that you live, was not actually preached by the historical Buddha, by the founder of the religion. This is actually one of the main points of criticism by Christians. So what Murakami tries to do, his unification project, is he assumes that this is true, that the Buddha didn't really speak the Mahayana. But he does emphasize, however, that while the Mahayana Sutras had not actually been spoken by the historical Buddha, there were historical developments of what the Buddha actually meant, and therefore equally valid in terms of Buddhism. This actually caused him a lot of trouble, so much that precisely because of this work, of this Bukyo Toitsuno of 1901, he actually had to abandon the Jodo Shinshu, the Otenihan, right? He had to kind of like return his priestly license. Like, there's no, in Japanese you say like soseki hakudatsu, but he wasn't actually stripped of his rights, actually returned it himself. Like, so, but it was mainly because of the whole impact and the criticism that received after publishing this work.
Just to add briefly, the concrete passage we selected for the book and that Ryan Ward translated for the volume again emphasizes faith, right? Interestingly, so the commonality that at least in this passage Murakami does take, that does find among the various diverse and heterogeneous Japanese sects is again faith. So it's something, it's appropriated certainly from a non-Buddhist discourse, but it's taken to somehow now be a fundament of Buddhism, of Japanese Buddhism, and actually something that can unify Japanese Buddhism. Quite interesting. Certainly something that couldn't have been written even a few decades earlier, although it does come across as a purely Buddhist tract in several ways.
And it's also interesting to note that he publishes, again, I think I just mentioned it very briefly, but in 1890, he publishes an earlier work, but he attempts something similar. It's much shorter. It's titled like Bukyo Ikando, on the consistency of Buddhism. It has been translated into English in this a mythic PhD dissertation by Kathleen Staggs, like that, you know, has never published, but, you know, has a translation of both Murakami's Bukyo Ikandon, and I think of part of Inoue Enryo's Bukyo Katsuron, the Joron, right? So it's actually quite interesting because in his earlier work, he doesn't really emphasize faith the same way that he will in 1901, right? And it's also interesting to, regarding Murakami, to note that he's this 1901 work, it's supposed to be the first of a series of five works on the consistency of Buddhism. So this is actually the first one, the general overview of the topic, but he has like, he envisaged five works that he doesn't actually get to publish. He publishes three of them. He never publishes a fourth volume. And 2 years before his death, in 1929, he publishes, you know, the two last volumes and sort of like retcons volume four, like to another work he had published earlier. But it's a life, long project that he envisaged around this time. He knew that, you know, it wasn't something that he could accomplish with just one work.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't realize that this was a lifelong project, but I think you can... It makes sense when you read it. I mean, it feels like it's part of something much bigger in that sense. I wanted to move on to the social reform section. I found Shimaji Mokurai's On the Relationship Between Man and Woman, which he wrote in 1888, to be quite fascinating here. As Hans Martin said in the introductory section of the podcast today, you know, there's a lot of ways in which Buddhism is engaging with social reform. In my own research, I always, working on the school lunch program, I constantly come across the Buddhist school, which is reputedly the, you know, origins of the origins of the school lunch program, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's a big part of the social actual history and also kind of the social imaginary, I think, of this turn of the 20th century in Japan. But here, Shimaji Mokurai is discussing education for women from the point of view of a Buddhist. And he has this very complicated, nuanced view of the need for women's education, which I think reflects some interesting things about him as an individual, but also his milieu, his time. He's attempting to negotiate between Christianity, Confucianism, and Buddhism, and as he concludes, to consider the strengths and weaknesses of East and West and find a kind of middle path, right? And so he's really exemplifying so many of the things that you've talked about, and that's why this particularly seemed a representative sample from this section.
Yes, thanks. As you said, it might come across as nuanced and complex, but it might also strike contemporary readers as contradictory, perhaps, because at the same time, he's trying to advance the case of girls' education. On the other hand, he's emphasizing, he's very clear about emphasizing a division of labor along gender lines, very, very strictly, even biologically determined division of labor. So it sounds contradictory, I think it will to many contemporary readers. But it's actually, as you already pointed out, it's quite representative of thoughts on women's girls' education, not only in this period, the Meiji period, but basically up to World War II, perhaps even the early post-war period. If you look at discourses on women's girls' education, there are many people who are willing to advance it institutionally and say it's really important, but most of them are pretty clear, and that includes women actually, not just men talking about women, that there should be the actual substance taught should be different, and the men and women should be taught different things. So it's quite pervasive in that sense. Shimaji is perhaps less representative of Buddhists in the 1880s, but more of the more general discourse on women's education in even pre-war up to mid 20th century Japan. Quite interestingly. So yes, he, and I think that's significant in itself in the 1880s that he's one of the first to say women's education must be expanded. The state at this point in time is very reluctant to do anything beyond elementary education for women. And it's mostly from the private sector that the so-called girls' higher schools, which is basically middle education for women, is established in this period. It's Christians, but also Buddhists. And Shimaji himself actually founded a school, one of those girls' higher schools, a private Buddhist school for girls. So he was actively involved in this. He's not just theorizing about it. His own positionality, of course, as you all also hinted at, is interesting because he is among the first Japanese Buddhist priests to travel to Europe and actually encounter Europe firsthand. And although he doesn't, as far as we are aware of, he doesn't read any European language, he is basically one of the experts on Europe, European things, among Buddhists, certainly, up to this period. This is written at a time when just now, basically, the more serious travelers, Japanese Buddhist travelers to Europe emerge, and then will come back and bring back more well-founded knowledge. So he's one of the people who's actually studied Europe a bit more in this period, a bit more than his contemporary. So he speaks from a position of authority. And as you can see, he's trying to say it's not the issues debated here are not East-West dichotomies, but the differences are sort of at a different level. And actually in the West, in Europe as well, people have the same ideas about women's education, about the division of labor. So he's saying it's not so much a question of progressive West versus reactionary East, and this reactionary East then supposedly informed by Buddhism, by old Buddhist ideas that need to be overcome. So he's arguing against that. He's saying, no, in fact, there are old ideas both in East and West, and the good ideas that you can find, you'll find them both in the West and in the East, and they're actually associated with Buddhism. And then he sort of quotes from scripture, but he's pretty ecumenical about it. It's not a very Buddhist text in that sense. He quotes from Confucian texts. He's very eclectic. As long as he can drive home his point, he's not shy about borrowing from here and there. So although this is published in a Buddhist journal, and I think the audience would be broadly Buddhist priests, laity, he's actually quite broad in his approach. His main point is it's basically defending Buddhism against the point that socially Buddhism is reactionary in some way. And he's saying, no, sort of what we need for our time, a modern division of labor for women and men, that's actually something that Buddhism can support. And I guess in a way, his practice, his social practice, his building founding school sort of proves his point in a way, even though theoretically it sounds a bit weak if you read this excerpt here translated in our volume.
Can I add something? It's also interesting to note that he's going against the trend. He's criticizing like the contemporary trend that associates a civilization with the West, right? Like it's something that Endo does as well. Like he's trying to say that things are not better in the West because he's trying to disconnect both things, right? To try to say that Japan can be as civilized and so on. Martin, can you? Sorry.
Yeah, it's actually I would put it a bit differently. He's disassociating civilization from Christianity, because the argument that, of course, in this period is that Christian missionaries will say, if you don't convert, you'll stay barbaric, because look at European civilization, North American civilization, it's all based on Christianity. So Shimaji, from very early on, even in the early 1870s, he writes, literally he says, that even three-year-old children, when he comes back from Europe, even three-year-old children know that European civilization is not based on Jesus, it's based on Greece and Rome. So this is a point that he picks up very early and is trying to bring home very forcefully.
Well, that's it. That's very interesting. I did not know that about him. And I think it does change a little bit of the way I would read him. That's fascinating. So I want to move on to one last selection from the volume, and that is the section on Japan and Asia. I want to look at the Japanese people's spirit. This is a text originally written in 1912 by a Zen priest named Shakusoen, and that makes it the sort of newest, the youngest, if you will, of the texts we're talking about today. And I think that's important because Soen is kind of, I mean, I guess maybe this is an uncharitable reading this time, but he's acting as an apologist for Japanese expansionism in Manchuria. I'm not sure how to sugarcoat that. And he's doing this as a guest of the almighty Southern Manchurian or South Manchurian Railroad, which we know as Mantetsu. So this is the record of a lecture which he gave in Busan. And it's full of what the translator, much more charitably than I have, calls questionable rhetoric. And this is, I think, significant because you have a Zen priest and Mantetsu making sort of questionable bedfellows, if you will, but also because Soen was a predecessor to, for example, D.T. Suzuki in popularizing Zen for Western audiences. So the section that's translated here starts with a call for 3 minutes of silent meditation. And I'd love if you could just sort of pick up your analysis from there.
Well, I would, first of all, let me say that I would agree that it's very difficult to sugarcoat what's happening here. And perhaps one of the most significant aspects of this is that this is from 1912. I mean, in many respects, it reads like it could be from the 1930s. And of course, we know very well about all the Zen at War stuff that Brian Victoria sort of introduced to English language readership a while ago. So we know about the sort of the excesses, how Zen priests and the clergy went along with Japanese imperialism in the 1930s and early 40s. But it's a bit It's a bit perhaps surprising to some readers to read this from 1912, where it's already pretty straightforward in many respects. As you said, difficult to sugarcoat. I think one needs to add that it's very significant that this is Shaku Soen. He's at this point in time already very, I think, pretty famous among Japanese Buddhist priests, probably one of the most famous. He was, three decades earlier? He was in the U.S. for the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago, one of the Japanese representatives. And so he's a very authoritative spokesperson for Japanese Buddhism. But I think what one probably needs to keep in mind is the audience or the particular place and opportunity that this text comes about. It's a speech, it's a lecture, it's a public lecture given, as you said, in Manchuria. The audience is apparently school children, perhaps employees of the South Manchurian Railway Company. So it's more so like a general populace audience. Shaku Soen doesn't speak so much perhaps as a Zen priest, although he does also emphasize that, perhaps more as a public intellectual. And you kind of wonder who set the topic for this talk. It's a bit unclear whether this was sort of, he was asked to speak on this topic or whether he picked it himself. He certainly willingly engages in it and gives a very official sounding reading of the Japanese people's spirit, as the title of the talk goes. It's very affirmative of Shinto. He talks a lot about kami, very respectfully quotes from the Kojiki. Some of this, as I said, it's a bit perhaps surprising to read this in 1912. Much of it is also a bit boilerplate, I guess, self-orientalism. He talks about Bushido how that is connected to the spirit of the Japanese people. He talks about, as our translator notes in a footnote, he talks about the Japanese people in racialized terms. He talks about Minzoku, Yamato Minzoku. And of course, he picks up Bushido partly because he then can connect it back to Zen. So, if he talks about all this Shinto stuff, quotes the Kojiki, what does all of this have to do with Zen? This is one way to connect it, of course, through the idea that supposedly the Japanese spirit of his contemporary time is marked by Bushido, which is a historical force, and that is shaped by Zen. So, as I said, it's pretty much boilerplate in a way, I think, already by 1912. Something that, Nitobe Inazo in his Bushido book has put forth and has made quite a splash abroad in the English language sphere, as well as at home in Japan. The other thing he does, the other thing he does is that he does talk about Zen in somewhat abstract terms more at the beginning. And it's a bit difficult to see how this connects actually to the rest of the his argument. And he does define Zen as the mind, pretty abstractly. It sort of tries to separate the Zen establish it as an idea and separate it from practice to some degree, and that does prefigure D.T. Suzuki, I guess, in many ways. It sounds quite a bit like Suzuki-style Zen in many passages. Of course, Shaku Soen was Suzuki's teacher, and they had a very close relationship. Suzuki translated many of his texts into English. You can see in many passages how close they were, and you can see Shaku Soen's contribution to the emergence of this 20th century idea of Zen that then became so successful in the West in this text. So it's interesting for that as well. Beyond the specific context here in Manchuria.
Yeah, and again, I mean, the thing I was sort of cueing on is precisely that, right, that you have this direct lineage to D.T. Suzuki and the popularization of Zen, outside of Japan, particularly in the West, which stands in a sort of interesting contrast, I think, is, again, let's try to use charitable language here, to the sort of openly expansionist, imperialist sort of connotations and I think denotations in what's in the speech here. And so I think, you know, and again, this is precisely why it's interesting as a part of the book for me, is that it really does show the struggles with modernity and modernization, right? And you can't sidestep imperialism in that. You can't sidestep the expansionism. So in that sense, I think it's a really interesting way to, that brings us into the 20th century with in a sort of tantalizing way, I hope, for our listeners as well, who I'm obviously encouraging to read, you know, the more of the sources, because as wonderful as our conversation was today, it doesn't do justice to the fact that there are actually 20 sources. And so I hope that people will engage with all of them. But we are reaching that point in the podcast where I start to ask you if you want to plug your social media accounts. Where I start to ask you what you're working on these days. Hans Martin, are after a big project like this, what are you working on these days?
Well, after having spent quite some time on the question of modernization of Buddhism in Japan, and also have a monograph on Shimaji Mokurai, whom we talked about, I kind of switched in a way to the reverse view, i.e. the reception of Japanese Buddhism in Europe. So I've been looking a bit at the early stage, so that the pre-Zen boom stage of the Japanese reception, of the European reception, Western reception of Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, focusing on the very earliest stratum of this, the 1870s, 1880s, which is where Zen was not really popular at all. People were looking more at Pure Land Buddhism. Jodo Shinshu priests were quite active in reaching out to Europe, publishing in English, French, on Japanese Buddhism. And this was actually quoted then by, say, European scholars of religion. So the image of Japanese Buddhism up to, say, around 1900 was actually colored. It's one of the findings of this project that I'm working on, sort of finishing up on right now, more by Jodo Shinshu and a bit Shingon than the later Zen. There are also other topics such as the faith in Amida. This is a thing that's associated much more with Japanese Buddhism in the West up to that point.
Fascinating. Thank you. Orin, how about you? What are you doing these days?
I'm working on two, like, more or less parallel projects. Like, one is on, actually has to do a little bit with Nakanishi Ushiro. He's one of the characters of this study, is on how this idea of the European Reformation impacted, you know, Japanese Buddhists, how they spoke of the European Reformation, how they had that as a model for a while, and then how they kind of like overcame it. Like, so it's a project that starts like in the 1880s, even before Nakanishi Ushiro made this connection, you know, of between the European Reformation and this new kind of Buddhism that, you know, was expected to appear in Japan. You already had people like saying pretty much the same thing, like Kitabata Kedoryu and, you know, similar characters. And that goes on all the way like into the late Meiji years. Like, so I'm trying to sort of like make sense of the European Reformation as a trope, how that functioned in the formation of modern Japanese Buddhism. And the other project I'm working on is how the image of Shotoku Taishi developed in the modern period, like especially during the 50s and 60s, is something that not too many people have looked at yet. So it's a more post-war focused project.
Well, those all sound like very interesting projects, and it sounds like I might have the chance to have one or both of you back on the podcast at some point, maybe not together. But I do want to thank you for a really fascinating conversation today, and for taking the time to talk with us about the book. I want to just encourage again our audience to take a look. Thank you both.
Thank you, Nathan.
Thank you.